I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway. On Monday, the City Council of Evanston, Illinois, approved Phase 1 of a reparations program which aims to address the economic damage caused to Evanston's Black residents by decades of discriminatory housing policies. The program is one of the first of its kind in the United States, but the issue of reparations isn't new. For decades, the nation has grappled with whether or how to provide the descendants of enslaved people with some form of economic reparations to close the gaping wealth gap those racist policies created.
You had this long journey that I think is part of the historical record. Nobody can factually dispute it. And then the question is, what does it all mean for the conditions that many communities still find themselves in right now?
Close the racial wealth gap, absolutely.
We have to retell the story of the last 400 years.
Sign into law a reparations bill.
Reparations for slavery would allocate federal resources to me, but not to an American with the wrong ancestry.
The matter of reparations is one of making amends and direct redress. But it is also a question of citizenship.
We're always a work in progress in this country, but no one currently alive was responsible for that.
Is it going to be more lip service? Is it going to be something that just sounds great?
See, the legal question is, the federal government can't constitutionally provide compensation today to a specific racial group because other members of that group, maybe several generations ago, were discriminated against and treated inhumanely.
Clearly, we require reckoning to restore national balance and unity. A reckoning, a healing, reparative justice. We need to bring our nation together.
No hesitation. We demand our reparations.
No hesitation.
We demand our reparations.
While the policy is part of a larger plan to distribute $10 million to Black Evanston residents over the next decade, critics say it's not enough and that the city and the federal government could do more. I'm Tanzina Vega, and today on The Takeaway, we break down the path to reparations for Black Americans, starting with a look at Illinois.
I just simply ask, why not? And why not now?
Nkechi Taifa is a human rights attorney and commissioner of the National African American Reparations Commission. Nkechi, welcome back to the show.
Greetings, Tanzina. Glad to be with you again.
And Marsha Chatlin is a professor of history and African American studies at Georgetown University and the author of Franchise, The Golden Arches in Black America. Marsha, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Nkechi, your initial thoughts on the plan that the city of Evanston, Illinois, has set out for its Black residents.
Well, actually, this is just a first phase. This first phase will actually begin the process in Evanston of an official reckoning of its past and the healing that can come from a reparation settlement. I think it's great. I'm thrilled. I think it is a model and a blueprint for the rest of the country.
Marsha, your initial thoughts on the reparations policy being proposed in Evanston right now?
I think it's complicated. I think that cities realizing that they have a responsibility for the harms of the past of its Black residents is good. But I hope that as other cities debate similar actions, that they are a little bit more aggressive in their reparation strategy.
Nkechi, let's talk about some of the specifics, because there are $400,000 available during this phase. As you mentioned, this is something that's happening in phases. Each of the grants that are being proposed are up to $25,000 each. How much of a dent is that actually going to make against centuries of discrimination? Or is this, as we said, the first phase of something that could then expand?
It is really critical to understand that this is the first phase. This is only 4%, 4% of the $10 million over 10 years that has been earmarked from the legal cannabis industry in Evanston to address these historic wrongs. This is a mere drop in the bucket. It's not anything close to or near or even purporting to be for reparations. It is a start, it is a beginning, and it is the beginning that the residents of Evanston, by and large, agree with. Of course, everyone is entitled to their opinions. Of course, no entity is monolithic. Of course, there are disagreements with respect to this, but it passed on Monday by an overwhelming 8-1 vote. And again, I'm proud to have been part of the process in Evanston almost from the day one with respect to this whole process of providing just a modicum of historical acknowledgement and earmarked monies towards this harm, this injury.
One of the biggest, there are many, many, many issues that arise when people talk about reparations, particularly at the policy level. And, you know, there's sort of, and we've talked a lot about that on this show. Both of you have been with us for that. Marcia, there is a question of why not just direct cash payments? Why the decision to distribute funds as housing grants?
I have the same question. I think that when reparations are couched within predetermined and approved places in which money should be spent, I think it undermines the heart of what a reparation strategy can do. I think that at times there's a little bit of a paternalistic view that people have to be told what to do with money or how to invest it responsibly. And so I am a big proponent of direct cash aid because we also know that the housing market, particularly in Evanston, is quite expensive. Median home prices range in the $400,000 plus area. And so I would be more comfortable with direct cash assistance because I think it says that we trust you and we believe that this is money that is owed to you and you can use it in the ways that you see fit for yourself and your community.
That said, however, we also know that housing discrimination, redlining, and other issues were one of the biggest discriminatory factors that didn't allow Black Americans to really gain wealth. There's so much wealth in this country that really starts at the housing level. So, Marcia, do you see sort of any positives here in terms of, you know, as a first step, as one of the first programs of its kind to focus on housing versus direct cash payments? Or is your vision of a reparations program really a question of getting direct cash payments to the descendants of enslaved Americans?
I will always support direct cash payments, and I understand the deep desire for entering the housing market, but I think something we have to keep in mind that some of those discriminatory practices continue today in lending, in access to prime rates, and also in communities in which African Americans want to live around other African Americans, we still see the disparity in housing values. And so I think we have to be very critical of the idea that entry into the real estate market is colorblind and will ultimately provide financial rewards for future generations, because we know that African Americans, even in places that are particularly affluent, sometimes have not fully recovered from economic recessions and aren't able to have the kind of home value appreciation of their white counterparts.
Nikichi, when you hear Marcia's thoughts on this program, I know that you were a part of it and you're very proud of it. What do you think about that? Should the emphasis be on direct cash payments in future programs going forward? Or in this particular case, will this sort of provide an alternative model to that, that people might be, that policymakers across the country might be more attracted to?
Tanzina and Marcia, I just want to make something perfectly clear. I am absolutely personally not opposed to cash payments or direct benefits to individuals. In my humble opinion, the harms from the enslavement era and post-slavery degradation were multifaceted. Thus, the remedy must be multifaceted as well. As a lawyer, I know very clearly that if I go out and get hit by a car and I go to court, I'm going to be looking for some cash payment. But again, that is just one part. A reparation settlement can and should be much, much more than that. That's not to say the cash payment is not a part. I personally believe it can and should be. But I also know with respect to the Evanston program, there is 90%, 96% more that is to come. This is only a 4% drop in the bucket.
Nikichi, let's talk about that. What is left to come? Tell us about the subsequent phases of this program.
Well, yeah, the allocation was $10 million over 10 years. This is only $400,000. We have I'm not a mathematician, 96,000 or whatever more there is to go. There will be continue to be town halls and discussions. There's a community stakeholder group that has been established. There'll be debate, there'll be discussion. And I am quite certain, I'm sure, I mean, upon information and belief, that somewhere along the line, there will probably be direct payments in the form of cash to individuals. I know there are a lot of things that are to be worked out. Number one, you don't want any tax consequences to that. I think that was one of the issues that had come up. And in the short period of time that there was to really get this pilot program off the ground, I think the decision was made to deal with it in this fashion, a $20,000 forgivable loan, home improvements, et cetera, in the housing industry, based specifically on a very comprehensive report that historians in Evanston did with respect to the harm in that particular community during a specified period of time.
Earlier this month, the Jesuit Conference of Canada and the United States pledged to raise $100 million for the descendants of enslaved people that they once owned. Marcia, what do you expect to see out of that?
I think that that initiative will be an interesting test case about churches and their sense of responsibility for the descendants of the enslaved. I think what we will see are funds that will help descendants get education at Catholic institutions. I think that we'll see similar things to Evanston, where there will be very clearly earmarked funds. And I think there will be continued conversations about whether or not $100 million even comes close to making any kind of meaningful repair in the lives of people who their path was set forth because of the institution of slavery, and it was cut short at different turns. So I think we'll continue to see a lot of contention, and we'll continue to see a lot of structured and very guided approaches to distributing this money.
And when it comes to the distribution itself, there are often questions about who or how to approach that process, right? Like, who do we give reparations to? Who, you know, in the case of Evanston, for example, does someone have to prove that they were the victim of housing discrimination, or is it sort of accepted that anyone in the community may have been affected by that? How do you see the distribution mechanisms themselves evolving?
Well, I think that the problem of specificity in saying only X number of people have access to reparations, we lose sight of the totality of white supremacy in impairing the possibilities in people's lives. I think what will be interesting to see is that with the rise of the DNA kind of family tree and genealogy business, the ways that those industries will kind of sidle up to these ideas to try to sell their products. I think that's the first part of it. But the idea of proving racial harm, we know how difficult that is to do in the courts. And so I would hope that these reparation structures don't put ridiculous or egregious burdens on people who are seeking relief. And I hope that these conversations don't lead into a kind of common sense understanding of racism, that some people are impacted, instead of understanding the ways that racism shapes all people, regardless of the outcomes in their own personal journeys.
Marcia, when we look at the movement at the federal level, Democratic Congresswoman Sheila Jackson Lee reintroduced H.R. 40 into Congress in January. The bill, which has been reintroduced repeatedly since 1989 and which we've spoken to Nikichi about in the past, would establish a commission that would look into the vast impact of slavery and come up with solutions. How do you think that the move in Evanston will actually or potentially affect federal legislation related to reparations? Will they begin to potentially turn away from thinking about cash payments?
Well, I think that H.R. 40 is, as someone who comes from academia, you know, slow death by meeting. This idea that we need more research or more deliberation, I think, is just not true. What I do think will happen is that these local level initiatives may provide a set of proof of concept ideas to take to the federal government to say, look, this is one way we can do it. This is another way. And I think it adds more nuance to the conversation about reparations. But I think, unfortunately, there is no political will on the part of Washington to actually get this done. And so I think our best bet is to create a network of localities that are willing to take up the issue of reparations and think about the various ways to fund them and structure them.
Nikichi, you're working on that. We've got a minute left. Do you agree with Marcia on that point? Or do you think the feds are the federal government is just not really going to get it done?
I think that there's more support now for the concept of reparations in H.R. 40 than there have ever been. We have more co-sponsors than ever. We have over 173 co-sponsors in the House. We have a bill that's been introduced in the Senate. We have a president that is has spoke positively with respect to a study. And it's more than just a study at this time. It's also to develop actual proposals. So I'm optimistic. I'm looking forward to the future. Reparations is an issue whose time has come.
Nikichi Taifa is the president of the Taifa Group, social enterprise firm, and commissioner of the National African American Reparations Commission. And Marcia Chatlin is a professor of history and African American studies at Georgetown University. Thanks to you both.
Thank you, Tessa.
Thank you.
Long before COVID-19, there was an affordable housing crisis in the United States, and like many other inequities we face as a society, the pandemic has only served to exacerbate it. As people with the means and flexibility to work remotely have slowly left metro areas, rental prices for the high-end luxury apartments they once occupied have fallen. Meanwhile, at the other end of the housing spectrum, people who have seen their hours cut, lost wages, or lost jobs altogether are noticing an increase in rent. For more on what's driving this inequity, I'm joined by Catherine Rampell, an opinion columnist for The Washington Post. Catherine, welcome to The Takeaway.
Great to be here.
What does the rental market look like these days? I mean, I'm sitting in New York and looking at luxury apartments that people are saying that they can snatch up much more easily now. But tell us what the landscape really looks like.
It really depends on what rental market you're talking about. So yes, at the high end, luxury buildings with lots of amenities, new construction, that sort of thing, there are great bargain basement deals to be had. Not just in New York, but in virtually every big metro area. On the other side of the spectrum, the lower end apartments, so those that might be older, fewer amenities, more run down, those places have either held steady in their rents or even increased. So it's this strange bifurcation depending on, the kind of neighborhood it is, the kind of building it is.
And is this happening nationwide or is it happening in big cities only?
So I have national data from a company called CoStar, and that is the general trend nationwide. There's some variation by city. So for example, in San Francisco, prices have gone down across the board, whether you're living in the fancy ritzy housing or the lower end units, your prices have fallen. But even there, the prices have gone down much more for the high-end housing. They're down about 20% for what CoStar calls 4- and 5-star housing, whereas it's maybe around 3 or 4% for the lower quality units. But generally speaking, this is the pattern across the country. And again, each city has its own dynamics, its own quirks and zoning restrictions and everything else that might affect things. But this is the basic pattern that we see.
What's driving a lot of this change? Because is it that there were too many luxury apartments? And I know that in many big cities, and like I said, I'm talking to you from New York, there's just seems to be a glut of luxury apartments that weren't really being filled even before the pandemic. Is it just a question of supply or is there something else?
So there are a few different things going on. At the top end of the market, yes, there was a lot of new luxury housing that came on the market. They may have been years in the pipeline that happened to become available last year. So there was an increase in supply. Meanwhile, there was also a decrease in demand because anybody who had the means to leave dense urban housing, which for various reasons was no longer as attractive as it once was, when all of the perks of city living, or many of them, had been shut down, restaurants, bars, museums, what have you, those people left. And many of them, I mean, not everyone, obviously, but a lot of people decided, I've always kind of been on the fence about buying a house and moving to the burbs. Maybe now is the time. So a lot of people who had been in these higher end luxury buildings, particularly if they could work remotely, or they had children who were, you know, in virtual school, decided now is the time to find more space. And many of them ended up buying houses. So, you know, the housing purchase market is a totally different ballgame. That's been very hot over the past year. And there's been a shortage of inventory because all these people are leaving. So those two things combined, more supply, less demand, obviously leads to lower prices. Vacancy rates are up too. At the bottom end of the market, a whole bunch of other things are going on.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit about that, because there have been stressors on small landlords, for example. There have been rent moratoriums that have been put in place for people to who are struggling to pay their rent, particularly low income folks who might be struggling. But then you have landlords who may own, you know, one building who are saying that they, too, are struggling. So what's happening at the lower end of the market, Catherine?
So there are likely a few different stories, or a few different forces, I should say, that may be driving up rents at the bottom. One is that, as you point out, there's an eviction moratorium, which is generally a good thing for public health, a good thing for the financial security and housing security of the people who have lost their jobs, who might face displacement or even homelessness. But on the flip side of that, if you're a landlord who has, let's say, six units and one of your tenants cannot pay and will not be able to pay, and you don't have the option of getting that person out and getting in a new tenant, and your margins are already probably pretty low if you're a landlord at the bottom end of the market because those rents are close to operating costs, you might try to offset your losses from that one tenant by raising prices on everyone else. So if one guy can't pay, then extract more from the people who can. So that's one possible factor. Another is that with the recession predominantly hitting lower income, moderate income workers, there are a lot of people who decided, you know, now I really need to save money on my single biggest monthly expense, rent, and they're trying to move down the housing ladder. They're trying to downsize. They're trying to, you know, go to maybe lower quality buildings with fewer amenities. And there was already, as you point out, Tanzina, a shortage of those affordable units. So if you have more people chasing after the same amount of buildings, which were, you know, too few to begin with, they end up bidding up rents. So those things combined, you know, are probably driving some of this. And then finally, if you are a lower income tenant, you just don't have a lot of bargaining power. If your landlord, for whatever reason, maybe because they have people who can't pay or they just their expenses have gone up or whatever, if they ask you for more rent, because you just don't have that many options, right? There are not enough affordable housing units, and it's expensive to move, particularly during a pandemic. You need a security deposit. Maybe your income has gone down and you no longer meet the threshold of, you know, 3 times rent as your income, which a lot of landlords have. So people are kind of stuck. So all of those factors combined mean that lower income tenants, the people who have obviously suffered the most in terms of job loss, are also having to deal with the biggest increases in, again, their single biggest monthly expense, their rent.
We talked about, Catherine, how what's driving sort of the pressure on, particularly on the lower end of the housing market. But we also know that it's a challenge to build more affordable housing. Why is that? And are we going to see more affordable housing units coming on the market as a result of what the pandemic has wrought?
So anyone who has worked, has spent their lives working on housing issues will tell you, and I interviewed many of them for this piece, that it is always a struggle to get more affordable units, however defined, onto the market. And there are a lot of barriers in the way. One is that it's expensive to build. And if the margins are going to be smaller, if the returns from building a lower end unit are smaller, then developers are going to gravitate towards higher end buildings. Another is, even if you have subsidies to try to make the economics work, to say, okay, you know, we'll give you a tax abatement or whatever, there are often zoning or other regulatory issues. And even if you get rid of those, there's often quite a bit of NIMBYism, right? You see this all around the country in blue states and red states, that people don't want new construction, and they often children especially don't want new affordable housing, right? They don't want, they don't like the idea of like a bunch of poor people, as they conceive them, moving into their neighborhood. So there are many barriers, both political, regulatory, economic, that make it hard to get more units that are affordable to people onto the market.
We have a new HUD secretary, Martha Fudge. Has she or anyone in the federal government talked about alleviating this problem long term, or is this something that's solely in the hands of the states right now?
A lot of the regulatory issues and a lot of the hard work and strategizing about this really needs to happen at the state and local level. But that said, the feds could create better incentives to encourage state, municipal officials, whoever, to make this a priority. And there are, I should say, I think signs of hope that some of those complicated obstacles that I just talked about that make it harder to build or create new supply of housing, affordable housing, that those could be alleviated. And they are that, you know, there are already cities and states that are doing creative things because of the recession and because of the migration trends that we were just talking about. They're kind of reclaiming or converting existing buildings into additional housing. Some of them did it just as a temporary measure because of the pandemic. You know, they converted a motel or whatever into housing for people who would have otherwise been homeless. States and cities could think creatively about doing more of that, particularly if you find that in the years ahead, people stay, you know, some of the people who left cities end up staying in the suburbs, or there are other forces that led to more buildings becoming vacant and available for other uses. That's difficult. Not all office park buildings can be turned into housing, for example, but some buildings can be converted, and it's relatively easy to see how. There are other things that give me hope in any event, that now is a moment when we could have more political momentum, I should say, for affordable housing. And that's that I think we're in a moment right now where people seem to have greater faith that government can sometimes get stuff done. I mean, there's a lot of cynicism about that in the United States. I think that's sort of in our DNA as a country. But you look at how popular the American Rescue Plan was, it remains to be, and the Biden administration has obviously been advocating itself as a brain trust of people who can help come up with solutions to some of these longstanding problems.
Catherine Rempel is an opinion columnist for The Washington Post. Catherine, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Amber Ruffin has been a Black writer in mostly white spaces for much of her career. But her success has led to opportunities to make her own spaces and make them as Black as she wants.
Nothing feels better than being like, which Babyface song? Not that one, the other one. It's the feeling of writing without weights.
I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America for a conversation with comedian Amber Ruffin. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Tanzina Vega, and you're listening to The Takeaway. This week, jury selection concluded for the trial of Derek Chauvin, the former Minneapolis police officer who's charged in the murder of George Floyd. After a long, complicated jury selection process, the trial itself is set to begin on Monday. The recent jury selection process had been delayed mostly because of a legal dispute on whether a third-degree murder charge would be reinstated for Chauvin. And recently, there was another dispute on what type of past evidence would be allowed in the trial. So for the coming weeks, we'll be periodically checking in with reporters in Minneapolis who are covering the trial. Helping us today is Brant Williams, correspondent for Minnesota Public Radio News, covering public safety, criminal justice, and racial disparities. Brant, thanks for joining us.
I'm glad to be here.
So this week, the jury was selected, but it was delayed. Tell us about the delay. Why did that? What happened there? I know the judge was sort of wanting another juror, but there were questions about a certain juror. Break it down for us.
Sure. Well, as you mentioned, there was the initial delay. They didn't even start on time as far as jury selection. They took that one day because of that dispute over the third degree murder charge. But after that got sorted out by a court decision, then they went ahead with the jury selection. Now, one of those delays, or at least hiccups in the process, came after news was reported of a settlement between the Floyd family and the city of Minneapolis, this historic $27 million settlement. And so the judge went back. He had already selected a number of jurors. So the judge went back and called those seven of those jurors who had not, who'd already been seated before this news broke, and had to ask them, were you exposed to this news? If you were, did it have an effect on you? And he found that there were two of those jurors who couldn't put that news aside. And so he had to strike them. And that was a big setback. The judge was clearly annoyed by all this pretrial publicity and even made a statement at the end of court one day saying, everybody needs to stop talking about this. You know, and he was—
This being the settlement you're talking about.
The settlement, yeah. And he was pointing his comments mostly at the city of Minneapolis. He was very frustrated that the city brought this up. They chose to settle this at this time, right in the middle of jury selection on this high profile trial. So
do we know, have we
major...
heard anything from the city, Brandt, about the decision to do that? Because the timing, I mean, the judge really can't, you know, say much about it. It's news. But why do we know, why did the city choose to announce it at that time? Is there any word on that?
Yes, that question was put to the city attorney, Jim Rowiter, and he had said, that basically there's no good time to make a settlement of this amount and of this magnitude. And he said there was no guarantee that if they had waited several weeks or maybe even a couple months later, that this deal may have not been available. But, you know, there are people who push back on that who asked the question, well, why didn't the city just announce that they've reached a settlement, but they won't announce it until after the criminal trial?
And that's a good question. I mean, did they have any answer to that? Or, I mean, saying there's really no good time to do it feels like a non-answer.
Well, you know, this is one of those situations where they're faced in the middle of this large criminal trial. And by the way, the mayor of Minneapolis is running for re-election this year, too. I don't know if that was part of his calculations. I don't want to necessarily put that. But, you know, as journalists, we always keep that in mind when we hear about, you know, public officials making high profile decisions like this.
Brandt, let's talk a little bit about the evidence that will be introduced to the trial. There was a lot of sort of back and forth about what video evidence would be presented. What do we know about what they're presenting regarding Chauvin's past?
Right. So there's a lot of questions about Chauvin's record as a police officer, that he had been the subject of dozens or more than a dozen complaints. I've been talking to lawyers about that prospect of and basically why this type of evidence will not be presented. The rules of evidence would prohibit like what you would call character evidence, and that would include past incidents or complaints against Derek Chauvin that were not relevant to what happened on May 25th of last year. Now, there will be a couple incidents that will be allowed at trial that are based on incidents that Derek Chauvin was involved in, and they loosely involve him either being involved in or witnessing an arrest of someone who needed to be restrained, and the officers actually controlled this person in a way. In one of those instances, the officers controlled the person who was having an apparent crisis, and they moved that person on their side to keep them from possibly dying, and that would be a way to I guess illustrate the training that officers are given, how they're supposed to react in that situation. So that's going to be part of Chauvin's past that will come out at the trial.
And what about evidence regarding George Floyd? I know that there was talk about having some sort of video showing Mr. Floyd in the past. And how is that relevant, Brandt, to what the incident is that we all witnessed through video of his death?
Right. So that's some evidence that came from this May of 2019 arrest. Now, the judge has been very clear about how he wants to narrow the scope of that testimony and that evidence. He will allow a short clip of body camera video from an officer who approaches George Floyd in a car. The officer is pointing a gun at him, and the judge will allow the jury to see what transpired between that time when the officer approaches Mr. Floyd and then Mr. Floyd gets out of the vehicle. Now, Judge Cahill said he basically is, he wants to show, or at least he will allow the defense to show what physical reaction George Floyd had to having a gun pointed at him after having ingested drugs. But he said he will not allow the prosecutors to, the prosecutors to introduce testimony that would maybe opine how Floyd's behaviors could be seen as symptoms of anxiety or claustrophobia during the May 25th arrest. Now, this is all going to be closely watched by, I can imagine the judge is going to be keeping tight reins on how these lawyers try to argue, and they're going to walk up to a line perhaps, and the judge is going to make sure that they don't cross it. Because
what line, Brandt? Because I feel like when you're present, I have participated in juries and criminal cases in particular many years ago, and I'm just wondering the character references that you're mentioning here, you know, depending on who is seated in the jury, could really have an effect on this, on the outcome of this trial if they're presented, you know, unnecessarily.
Right, and again, that video evidence, including the video evidence from last year when Mr. Floyd died, to the May of 2019 evidence, is going to be very impactful. I mean, there's going to be a lot of people are going to see things that perhaps they had not seen before that 2019 video. So you're right. I mean, it does have the potential to really sway jurors to the defense's case. And that's something that the prosecutors have been trying to prevent. They've been trying to keep that evidence out of the case, of the testimony.
The trial is going to be televised. What are your thoughts on having the trial be televised? I mean, are we looking at, you know, this is something that was sort of a surprise to me. How are folks taking it there?
Yeah, it was. I was surprised as well, but I'm kind of pleased in a way for a couple different reasons. One is I just think this will be an educational experience for everyone who decides to tune in. As someone who's covered a lot of trials, you know, you get exposed, you see like the day in and day out types of drudgery even. There are sidebars, there are outside of jury discussions, there's lots of objections. You know, you may be sitting for a while with nothing happening, you know, during one of these sidebar conferences. They turn on some white noise in the courtroom so you can't actually overhear what they're saying. And so that's going to be something that the whole public is going to see, and that this is not like TV trials and dramas on TV showing lots of outbursts and, you know, objection. And so that's not going to happen. So people are going to see that. But it will be an odd setup being in the courtroom, not seeing a gallery of spectators, not feeling that buzz of energy that happens when a defendant walks into the courtroom and people stop their side conversations and watch him. So it's going to be very strange, but I think this could be a very educational experience for people who decide to tune in.
Of course, I'm imagining that there will be folks limited because of COVID-19. Are there any other differences that we should expect to see because of the pandemic right now?
Yeah, we're going to see plexiglass barriers between the lawyers and their teams, and between the defense lawyer and Derek Chauvin. The judge is going to be behind plexiglass, and the jurors, which you will not see the jurors, but the jurors in the courtroom are all separated into small desks that look like almost school desks. And so everybody is going to be spaced. And like I said, there will be no spectators to be in the courtroom watching.
Brandt Williams is a correspondent for Minnesota Public Radio covering public safety, criminal justice, and racial disparities. Brandt, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
We've just been talking about the trial of Derek Chauvin, the former Minneapolis police officer charged with murder in the death of George Floyd. As of this week, 14 people have been selected to serve on the jury. The identities of the jurors will remain anonymous throughout the trial, but we do know that they include 8 white people, 4 black people, and 2 people who identified as more than one race. Jury selection in the Chauvin trial has put a spotlight on the way we choose jurors across the country. Paul Butler is a former prosecutor and the Albert Brick Professor in Law at Georgetown University. Paul, welcome back to The Takeaway.
Hey, Tanzina. Great to be here.
Not all of us have served on a jury. Not all of us have had the pleasure of being a reporter in the jury room like I have. So a lot of folks, I think, we could use a refresher on how juries are selected. It's a really strange process called voir dire. How long can it take?
You know, when I did street crimes in D.C. as a prosecutor, a voir dire might take a couple of hours. In the Derek Chauvin case, it's 3 weeks almost. I've never heard of a voir dire that long. In part, it's because the jury has to be found to be impartial and fair. In that case, they're not expecting people who've never heard of the case. And almost all of the selected jurors had seen the video. But you have to find people who can be fair and impartial and only decide their verdict based on what's presented in court. And so in a typical jury selection process, there's a tension between the judge who has that goal of trying to get a jury that's impartial, objective, and fair. But the parties, of course, are looking for jurors who are going to lean their way.
And tell us about that tension, because I've witnessed voir dire. And like I said, I've been a person who was selected many, many moons ago to sit on a jury. So there are some instances where the prosecution and the defense are both looking for people to really fit their interests, right? How much sway do they have versus the judge in the jury selection process?
So in a criminal case, each side gets a certain number of strikes. They are called peremptory strikes, which they can use to exclude a prospective juror for any reason other than race and gender. If there's a case to be made that a juror cannot be fair, she's biased, she can't be objective, she knows something about the case that she can't set aside, then the judge can exclude that prospective juror for cause.
What are some red flags that prosecutors and defense attorneys are looking for when selecting a jury? You sort of touched on that just now, but can they, you know, in their strikes, can they say, oh, you have a prior criminal history, or you are, you know, someone who knew the community where the person lived and died? I mean, where ultimately is the line so that you do preserve some sort of, and I think, by the way, Paul, I wonder if this idea of impartiality is really real or not, but what are some real red flags for folks who might be attempting to get on a jury and defense and prosecution say, nope, that's definitely a no?
That's such an interesting question. In the questionnaire that went out to prospective jurors in the Floyd case, one of the questions was, do you want to be on this jury? And Tanzina, I was really interested in how the judge would respond to a juror who says, yes, I do want to be on this jury. What purpose would she have? So the judge, again, is looking for people who can be fair and only base their verdict on what the judge instructs them. As the parties look for people who they hope will favor their client, they're looking for clues. So in the Chauvin questionnaire, the defense attorney would start out telling the jurors, this case is not about race. And then he proceeded to ask a bunch of questions about race, how they feel about Blue Lives Matter, Black Lives Matter, bias in the criminal justice system. You're looking for markers. And again, the parties can exclude jurors for pretty much any reason other than race and gender. And so when I was a prosecutor, we were instructed to strike people who are very religious based on the concern that they might not want to sit in judgment on other people. And we were also trained to try to exclude scientists based on the concern that they might have too high a standard of proof.
You say that jurors cannot be striked for race and gender, but Paul, you and I both know that there are ways to get around that. And they may not strike them for race and gender explicitly, but asking someone how they feel about Black Lives Matter, for example, might actually end up doing that. We're supposed to be judged by a jury of our peers. Is that happening in the Chauvin trial?
It is. The judge did a very competent job of overseeing jury selection. This is the first high-profile trial of a police officer after the death of George Floyd. And so we have a jury that is actually more racially diverse than the city where the trial is taking place. That's very unusual. There's also a critical mass of Black jurors. We know that it takes more than one or two jurors to make a difference. And so the presence of at least four African-Americans and two multiracial jurors could be significant.
Paul, how realistic is this idea of impartiality? I mean, no one, you know, journalists are supposed to have impartiality. And I think, you know, it's almost a false possibility, right? Is it realistic that we really leave ourselves at the door? I mean, are people able to do that?
You know, in jury selection in the Chauvin case, defense often tried to get jurors excluded who said that they had concerns about bias in the criminal legal process or that they supported the movement for Black lives. And the claim was that those jurors somehow could not be objective. You know, jurors are told to evaluate evidence based on their life experiences. And it's true that often people of color have different kinds of experiences with the police than many white people. But the judge, to his credit, said that those experiences, the experiences of people of color, are as valid as any other experiences.
We know that juries historically are not really reflective of the diversity of this country. Do you see this as optimistic to sort of jury selection going forward? Are you optimistic that this might be a signal to jury selection going forward?
This is such a high-profile case. I think the diverse jury was very intentional on part of the judge. And again, the judge carefully policed the selection process to make sure that race wasn't a factor. That is not the case in the vast majority of trials. The Supreme Court case that says that you can't use race as a basis to exclude jurors is called Batson. Batson is probably the most under-enforced Supreme Court case of all time. It asks lawyers to disregard race, but lawyers often think race matters in terms of who a jury is. And so it's asking a lawyer to respect the Constitution, even in a case where a lawyer thinks it might not be in the best interest of her client to ignore race.
Paul Butler is the Albert Brick Professor in Law at Georgetown University. Always great to have you, Paul. Thanks so much.
Always a pleasure.
Okay, everybody, it's Thursday. What a concept. Lots of good info today from all of our guests. And of course, call us with your thoughts and ideas at 877-8-MY-TAKE. That's 877-869-8253. Or send us a tweet. We're at The Takeaway. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.